Tonight with our guest Stephen Mailer, we talk about archaeology, science, ancient texts, and spiritual teachers. All this coming out of Egypt in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen Mailer has a B.A. in psychology and anatomy, holding a master's degree and one in natural science, and he's got another one in social sciences. In 1977, Stephen became associated with the Rosicrucian Order in San Jose, California, worked as a staff research scientist from 1978 to 80. Stephen has worked with the Mayan crystal skull, the Amethyst crystal skull, the Mitchell Hedges skull, and Max, which is the Texas crystal skull. In 1998, Stephen had the opportunity to work with Shannara, the skull owned by Nick Dosorino, and Stephen currently is the director of research of both the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association and the Land of Osiris Research Project. He has focused on the field of Egyptology for more than 35 years. He's a trained field archaeologist. In addition, Stephen is the author of The Land of Osiris and is currently working on a second book, which he has out now, called Light into Darkness, The Evolution of Religion in Ancient Egypt. He is our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Hi, Stephen, and welcome back.
Hi, George, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you.
There's lots going on these days in the Middle East, huh?
Yes, a lot of things. And, you know, we think we can explain some of it because what we're looking at is ancient struggles.
Is anything that we are going to talk about tonight, Stephen, have to do with supernatural powers of religion or supernatural things that caused the ancients to do what they did?
Wow, that's an interesting question. I focus more on the natural process than the supernatural, how these religions have evolved, how spirituality became religion, and a very practical understanding, more than a supernatural understanding, more a scientific approach or a practical approach than one that's just totally based on faith.
Why is it, do you believe, that the theory of religion or faith or spirituality all seem to occur around this region? Why there?
I think it's because of ancient Egypt. I have a bias, and that bias is, according to the indigenous tradition that I'm bringing forward, that, you know, humanity evolved in Africa. Now, there's other traditions, say Asia, the Polynesians, and, you know, there are many different groups, indigenous groups, that say they're the original people. But my research, because I've been fascinated with Egypt since I was 8 years old, has focused on Africa. And I see these systems all coming out of this region. And so that's why there's so much intensity there even today, as the news at the top of the hour, what's going on in Israel today.
Do you think whatever occurred in Egypt thousands of years ago then branched out throughout this entire world?
Yes, and that is a recurring theme in the current book I've written, From Light into Darkness, that our modern religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam evolved out of religious practices of ancient Egypt. And ancient Egypt itself was only a shadow of the spirituality of people, prehistoric people, over 10,000 years ago.
I was going to say, I'm curious to see what your take is on the longevity of the Egyptians. You know, are you a 5,000-year believer or a 10,000-year believer, or maybe even before that?
Even before that, because what we're going to talk about tonight is the oral tradition, the indigenous tradition that I have become associated with. I've been working with a man, Abdel Hakim Aoyan, who everybody knows is Hakim, for 13 years, and he is a master of the oral traditions of his country. And so his tradition says that it's been cycles, not a straight line of evolution, but cycles. And the current cycle goes back 65,000 years.
65,000 years?
Yes, that's a date that he's always been consistent about. And that's not the beginning, because they don't believe in beginnings. They just believe that the current cycle began 65,000 years ago, and we're coming to the end of that cycle now. So we're talking about a cycle of 65,000 years that's ending now, and we're beginning a new cycle. And this is why, before we're done tonight, we're going to give a message of optimism and hope for everyone.
Well, we're going to need that.
Yes, we do.
How old do you think the pyramids are?
I think Well, we jump right into it.
I don't waste any time, Stephen.
So, well, you know, I would like to, if I can indulge, if you can indulge me for a minute, I'd like to update everyone and yourself on what I've been doing this last year.
Okay.
And that will lead right into your question.
Okay, because you were last on with me July of last year.
That is correct. Okay. And since then, I just came back from a Holy Grail tour of Scotland with Mark Amaro Pinkham, who you've interviewed.
Yes.
And it was a wonderful experience. We went to Roslyn Chapel, and that, of course, could be a whole show in itself.
Mm-hmm.
And I was initiated into the International Order of Gnostic Templars, IOGT, that Mark is running with the Sinclair clan in Scotland.
So you're now
so
a
we're
going
to talk about the Knights Templar before we're done tonight.
Sure.
Because there's been many things written about them, most of them superficial. And so that's a magical place. And we had a wonderful experience. I'm working with body, mind, spirit journeys. And last year, in November, we had a tour and conference of Egypt. And this is going to lead into your question. As well as myself as presenter, it was Christopher Dunn, author of the Giza Power Plant.
Mm-hmm. We've had him on.
Yes. Wonderful man. And David Hatchett Childress, my publisher.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Pinkham.
Okay.
And we had over 60 people with us. It was a wonderful group, many of whom are listening tonight.
It sounds like a who's who of coast to coast, doesn't it?
And as always happens when I'm in the field with Chris Dunn, we made some discoveries. And we'll get into that. And I also just want to say before we go back on that I will be leading another tour to Egypt this coming October 25th through November 5th. Again, Lex was kind enough to put up the website for Body, Mind, Spirit Journeys. People can click on it, go to Egypt. It's going to be a wonderful tour. And, George, I hope someday that you'll come with me to Egypt.
Oh, one day, Stephen, I work so much. Sometimes
I know. That's only the problem if you could only get two weeks away.
Oh, 2 weeks in a row?
Yeah.
Fat
doesn't
chance.
Happen, huh?
Bad chance of that.
Yeah, because I'd love to show you these things in person. And that's really the strength of it.
I mean, unless one day we arrange a broadcast there.
Well, we could do that.
That way I'm not leaving the program, but I'm working while I'm out there.
That would be great, because if you could do that, I could arrange for you to interview my teacher personally from Egypt.
You know, Hakim, by the way, in Arabic means doctor.
Well, it also means wisdom.
That's right. Wisdom or doctor depends
on what... That's right. His name, Abdel Hakim, actually means servant or slave to wisdom, and indeed he is.
And so let's get back to, because I want to just mention this, and then we'll come back to the
sure.
rest of what we're talking about.
Sure.
Because so many people have had their own theories on how old they think the pyramids might be.
Boy.
I'm just curious to see what yours are.
Yes, and you're so right, because in my position as one of the directors of research of the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association, Chris Dunn is the other, we're constantly getting emails from people who have theories. Every day, a new theory. The Great Pyramid was this. It was built this way. It was built that way.
Mm-hmm.
And usually, everybody has a piece of it. But what we try to do is make a coherent understanding. And the indigenous tradition is very clear in saying that the pyramids were never built as tombs, ever. That's one theory that we won't even address. We won't even debate. But there are many other different ideas, and I think that Christopher Dunn has the complete theory that the Great Pyramid was originally designed to be a machine to
right.
produce power.
The fact that they probably buried some kings in there for a while was probably after the fact.
Yes, well, in the Great Pyramid, there was never a burial. But what you're saying is correct. In the later dynastic period, they did build pyramids as symbolic tombs. But and then even later times, people were buried in there. Well, my theory on that is that later people, seeing these great pyramids like at Giza and the other sites that I mentioned, wanted to be identified with the previous people who were only legend to them in their time period, and so that a lot of people wanted to be buried in the pyramids to be connected with them. But the Great Pyramid never had a burial of anybody.
Now, were they built by Egyptians, quote-unquote?
Yes.
Okay.
We call them Kemetians, not Egyptians. Cause
how do you spell that?
Is a Greek word. Kemet. Well, again, the ancient language didn't have vowels. So how it's usually written is K-M-T or Kempt. I put in vowels, so we spell it K-H-E-M-I-T. It's been spelled many different ways. And originally it was Kem. And if you think about it, one of the Arabic terms for Egypt today is Al-Kem. And that's where the word alchemy
right. comes from. Okay, so you're saying that this society preceded the Egyptians that we know of?
Yes. What we call the dynastic period begins around 5,000 years ago, as you mentioned. The date the Egyptologists like to use is around 3,100 B.C.
All right. And these were what, 65,000 years?
Yes. Yes. And the pyramids, you asked me that question, let's return to it.
Yeah, let's do
According to my research for over 37 years on the subject, the Great Pyramid was built in three distinct stages. The stages may have been separated by thousands and thousands of years, but original construction over 20,000 years ago.
Now that is spellbound.
Yes, but not by aliens and not by Atlanteans. Now, the subjects I addressed in my first book, we say indigenous African people were advanced, had not only the technology, but the consciousness. And that's a key thing that everybody who comes up with their little pet theories doesn't take into account, because we're not in that state of consciousness today. Everybody's looking for the nuts and bolts, the mechanical answer, and we can provide that.
But at least your theory, though, stresses that it was high technology slash consciousness that got this done.
Yes, and in fact, we don't separate it, and there wasn't a separation among these people. So Christopher Dunn and myself today, when people ask us what do we think the Great Pyramid was, we say it was a spiritual machine.
Well, whatever happened, though, Stephen, the thing that just baffles me is whatever happened to that high technology that was around then 65,000 years ago?
I think we're regaining it now.
Yeah, but where did it go in between?
Ah, good question. And I address that in the key, that's a key part of this current book. I believe, and it's amazing because you spoke about this, of an event happening 12,000 years ago in the news.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about, and it's not an original theory to me, it's actually two books that I really highly recommend, is a book called Cataclysm 9500 BC by two British scientists, Allen and Dallaire, and a book by Barbara Hand Clow called Catastrophobia. In those books discussing a worldwide cataclysmic event happening 11,500 years ago.
All right, very close. The story we had today.
I know. I love it.
Yeah.
I love when that confirmation comes in, because I do think that story is accurate, and I think we're going to find more and more evidence. So in this event, it could have been a cometary flyby. It could have been a huge meteorite strike. Something happened which knocked the Earth, not only caused a cataclysmic event, but actually put the Earth into its current tilt of 23.5 degrees, the wobble that we all know, and it disturbed everything around the planet. We're talking about tsunamis that I think were 1,000 feet high, not 100 feet like 200 feet, not 50 feet like happened in Indonesia last December, but 1,000-foot tsunamis roaring across North America, for example. And it probably almost completely wiped out all human civilization that was there.
What would cause these islands to sink? The force of the tsunami or the plates shifting underneath the land masses?
All of the above.
Uh-huh.
It all happened. Earthquakes took off, major splits. There actually was a man, and I forgot his name, he had a very interesting theory that he said what the source of the deluge, the flood, was not exactly rainfall, huge rain mass, but he actually has documented that there's a split in the Pacific, in the actual floor of the Pacific Ocean, that shows that it once ruptured. And people don't realize that there's actually more water inside our planet than there is in the oceans. So his theory is there was some event happened which caused a rupture in the ocean floor. Water came flying out, went as much as 50,000 feet into the air and then came down, and that's what caused the tsunamis. And he has documented evidence that shows that this rupture is less than 15,000 years old.
Is it cyclical? Assuming it wasn't caused by a comet or an asteroid or some other planetary force or universal force, if it was just an Earth force, it might be cyclical. It could happen again.
Yes. Yes. And the geophysical record shows at least six major extinctions in the history of our planet, where almost all life forms were wiped out. So these are cyclical events. And again, Hakim says, according to the indigenous tradition, this is a natural occurrence. Nobody was at fault. It's not because people, you know, the theory of Atlantis, people were abusing their power, mm-hmm. et cetera, et cetera. In his explanation of it, it's a natural cyclical event. It happens every certain number of years to end a cycle.
And regardless of your science or technology, you can't stop it.
Well, that's a great point, George, because that's one thing that always disturbed me, because we're going to talk about these cycles. And when this event that I'm talking about 11,500 years ago happened, we were in the highest state of consciousness, I believe. So couldn't people see it? Couldn't they do anything about it? Apparently not.
Apparently not, indeed. And I think when Plato writes about Atlantis sinking in this most current story that I had, where they call it near the Straits of Gibraltar,
right.
It's possible, and I believe Atlantis was a much larger continent.
Right.
There must have been other regions, other land masses all around the planet that must have gone under at the same time.
Agreed. And I actually think Atlantis was used as what I call a mythologem, a catchphrase. I prefer the term global maritime culture, because what we're discovering all the time off the coast of India, off the coast of Cuba, in the Bimini's, everywhere, is that there were advanced civilizations all around the planet over 10,000 years ago. And so that's not to say that there wasn't an island continent that, you know, is described off the Straits of Gibraltar, but The key thing here, and the key teaching that the indigenous tradition tries to tell us, is that there were advanced civilizations all over, and northern Africa was one of the highest advanced ones in the planet. And so they didn't need people coming from somewhere else to teach them how to build pyramids and to carve the Sphinx.
The Kemets, which were out there 65,000 years ago, and then the Egyptians with that span, did they die off and then we had nothing for a while?
No.
Or was there a chronology here?
There is a lineage. And again, archaeology has not shown a record. And in fact, there's a period which Barbara Hanclough calls the blank, where there doesn't seem to be any evidence. First of all, the impact on northern Africa wasn't the same like ice ages or major tsunamis like in other places. But the climate severely changed. What was once lush, tropical, or semi-tropical climate with a huge ancient river, which is today Western Desert, which was hundreds of miles across, thousands of miles long, rainfall ceased. It dried up. The rainfall, you know, and we all know that geologists can tell us that the Sahara Desert, the Libyan Desert, are less than 10,000 years old. So there was not desert before that. We're talking about a time period where all of northern Africa was lush and green with huge tributaries and advanced civilization. But the event severely knocked the Earth out of its orbit, changed climates all around the world, and the desert started to happen. So what happened to the Kemetians is many of them migrated out of Africa, went to other places, and they had to go to a less highly evolved lifestyle, because if the Great Pyramid was the machine that was producing out tremendous amount of energy, this whole grid line that I discussed in my first book, The Land of Osiris, 25 square miles, all had pyramids, all working on harmonic resonance, all producing tremendous amounts of energy, it ended. The grid was shut down almost overnight. So surely it severely impacted their lifestyle, and they had to go to a much less technological advanced lifestyle, but it didn't end. And then all of a sudden history seems to say that a lot of tribes come back into Africa, and we have this so-called dynastic civilization beginning 5,000 years ago. But it didn't just disappear. There is lineage, and I point to lineage in my two books, that there are artifacts, there are temples, there are structures that can be dated to those time periods to show that they were still building in stone, that they, you know, it decreased. So here we have, you know, a theory that's against what's taught in academia. The major paradigm that I'm really out for is this idea of linear evolution, that everything just gone from the primitive to complex in a straight line. No, we say cycles. So we went into a phase after these 11,500 years ago, for thousands of years, where civilization had to, like, start up again.
Do you nix theories of Zachariah Sitchin, for example, in his, you know, genetic altering caused by the people from Nibiru?
Yes.
Okay, you do nix
yes,
that.
Yes, in fact, you know, it's very interesting, the debate that's raging today, George, about evolution versus creationism, and now they've come up with this intelligent designer theory. Well, it's funny. One of the major themes that I introduce in my current book is the idea of a paradox, is that something can be true and apparently not true at the same time.
Let's talk about that when we come back.
Great.
Stephen. Stephen Mailer, our guest, his website, GizaPyramid.com, linked up with his name at coasttocoastam.com. tonight's program. We're talking about his new book called From Light into Darkness. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And with our special guest tonight, Stephen Mailer. We'll be back with Stephen in a moment as we talk about many facets of what happened in Egypt. Thousands, and according to Stephen, we're talking about thousands and thousands of years ago. Back in a moment. Okay, Stephen, let's get back to our business at hand here. This is fascinating.
Yes, and it's the idea of paradox. And how paradox is defined in the dictionary is how something can apparently be true and not true at the same time, or something that goes against received opinion. Now, what's received opinion? Well, that, of course, would be academia or religion, the ones that are giving us our ideas how things are. So we're led to believe today that everything has to be black and white. Either you believe in evolution or you believe in creationism. And now this idea of the intelligent designer theory, which a lot of people are criticizing, is just a backdoor attempt to get creationism into the schools. However, I want to present a different understanding of
all
it.
Right.
How I am not a supporter of a lot of the theories of Charles Darwin, yet it is obvious to me that there's evolution. And that's just simple observation. You observe nature, you observe animals, species, birds, and you see that they develop, they adapt to their environment, mm-hmm. they develop biological mechanisms to obtain food. That's obviously evolution, but that's what's called microevolution. Species do evolve, but the idea of macroevolution, has one species ever evolved into another? No proof whatsoever.
No proof at all.
And this is where creationism...
And those are huge jumps, Stephen, aren't they?
Yes. And this is the whole idea that they're looking for the missing link. Well, they want us to believe that we evolved from a common ancestor that branched off one way to apes and one way to humans. Well, I totally reject that. I will say to you that I believe the essence of human has always been, and it didn't evolve out of anything else. So in other words, that what we are is something that is universal. It's not just from this planet. So this then goes into creationism. Well, I believe in a certain degree of creationism, yet I don't believe there actually was a beginning. So you asked about Zechariah Sitchin.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about gods with a small g. Yes, George, in my opinion, I believe we are a genetically engineered species. The Earth is not our home. It is our planet. It's like a great laboratory, a great playground. But I think one day we will all know for sure when they come down in ships and when we greet them, and we will see that what we call extraterrestrials or aliens are human. And
the essence of human
has come from other planets in many different galaxies and solar systems.
You think this genetic altering was done then elsewhere, not necessarily on this planet?
Both. I think Sitchin's dates are correct, that between the biological, the archaeological, the paleontological record shows between 200,000 and 300,000 years ago, there was definitely a jump in the species that they think evolved into humans, what's called Homo erectus,
mm-hmm.
to Homo sapiens. So yes, I think we have been genetically altered on this planet, but by many. Where I disagree with Zechariah Sitchin, I sometimes have criticized him as being a one-trick pony. And he just sees it as Nibiru, he just sees it as Anunnaki. I see that there's a possibility that we've come from many different places. In fact, the indigenous teachers of Egypt say that they originally Kemet had 42 tribes, all races, all types of people. I think we may have come from 42 different directions in the sky. I mean, I think that's possible.
And did they all look the same, though?
No. I think all the different races may have come from different solar systems and also adapted on our planet.
Okay, so you think that every race that we have on this planet may have come from different regions of the universe?
I think that's quite possible.
That's an interesting theory.
Mm-hmm.
Indeed.
But an interesting theory also, again, what the indigenous tradition tells us, again, as being, I always define Hakim as an Afrocentrist, in that he sees Africa as the birthplace of humanity. So this teaching about ancient Kemet, 42 tribes were all races of people, including Caucasians, which should rightly be called the white race, because the Caucasian comes from supposedly the race evolved from the steppes of Russia, the Caucasus Mountains, and that's where the word Caucasian comes from. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of white people don't even know that that's where the word Caucasian comes from. But according to Hakim's tradition, white people evolved in Africa too. So this goes against another theory that a lot of African-American professors were promulgating, particularly in the 70s, this what was called the Nile Valley School, that said that the ancient Egyptians were all black. And we disagree with that, too.
Well,
they certainly were black.
Has modern science ever explained, then, where the different races came from or how the different races came to be? I mean, you're right. If you look at this planet, we have, I don't know, how many do we have?
They say five major, but you know, there's so many different combinations.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, but does modern science explain why they're different in appearance? Have they ever done that?
No, just local adaptation. Again, using Darwinian evolution, so Asian people develop their particular eyes or skin color because they evolved in Asia. Black African people, because of African climate, was the way it is. White people, because supposedly from northern regions where they didn't need the melanin in the skin to protect from the sun, et cetera, et cetera. But that
that makes sense, though, doesn't it?
Yes, for local adaptation. But we're talking about once Africa was a beautiful climate. It was once all tropical. And also we're talking about the fact, and Barbara Clough points this out in her book, that there's no evidence prior to 10,000 years ago that there were four seasons.
Well, why would Orientals, for example, have the kinds of shaped eyes that they have? What would be its purpose in that region of this world?
Good point. Again, biologists will always come up with a theory. Maybe there was windstorms, sandstorms, and the eyelids were that way to protect the eyes. But, you know, when you really rigorously, it doesn't hold up. And the only other explanation is they may have come from a different star system.
That one makes more sense to me.
And me too.
Now, let's talk about Hakim, because he appears to be a major person in your theories and in your research. Tell me more about him.
Yes. Hakim is an extraordinary individual, and how I came to him, you know, to make a long story short, I have been interested in Egypt for 37 years, formerly, again, more than 50 years since I was 8, but it was a little-known book in 1968 called Moses and Monotheism, which we hope we'll return to maybe in the next hour, that led me to really want to investigate Egyptology seriously. And so I began to investigate academic Egyptology, read voraciously on my own. Well, the answers didn't seem to be there. So then I moved away from that into the so-called metaphysical, mystical aspect and joined the Rosicrucian Order, got involved there. There seemed to be even something else, but it was a particular book for me in 1990 called Ancient Egypt, The Serious Connection, written by a wonderful woman named Murray Hope, who was a Wiccan priestess. And she talked about that there still was a tradition existing in Egypt, and they kept the old ways. In other words, they were not Muslim, they were not Christian, they were before Jewish, and they were before even the dynastic time period. And that was a clue to me. And there was another gentleman named who just recently passed away this year, named Dr. Albert Das, a native-born Egyptian, high-ranking Rosicrucian, who I met with in 1992. He confirmed that there was an oral tradition still existing in Egypt, and he urged me to go find it. So I went 1992, the first time in Egypt, specifically trying to find this indigenous tradition. And lo and behold, the first day I'm in Egypt, the tour guide for the group that I'm involved with was Abdel Hakim. And I saw him standing in front of the Sphinx. Immediately, the Sphinx said to me, "This is the person you've been looking for." And as soon as I heard him speak, I knew that he was privy to some other kind of information. Now, the unique thing about Hakim is that he is Western trained, that he's had an interest himself in his own history of his own country since he was 6 years old.
Well, where did he get his wisdom?
First he went to school. He studied to be an archaeologist, Egyptologist. But his tribe, the Awiyani tribe, are wisdom keepers. So they form a tradition of the oral tradition. Now, what is the oral tradition? Well, the oral tradition basically is how histories were kept before writing. So this is a tradition that exists in Asia, in among indigenous Native American people, South American people, Mayan people, and particularly in Africa, that histories were kept between specific tribes, and they were rigorously kept. So from an early age.
So let's say there were five of them. they would keep this within themselves, maybe tell the tribe, but it was their responsibility to keep this oral tradition. And then let's say they picked five youngsters who would replace them.
Very good.
They kept telling them, and then it just went on and on and on, right?
Yes. Okay. And so from a young age, Hakim sought out all the elder indigenous wisdom keepers of his country. He met, I mean, he told me about when he was a young boy, he had teachers who were very old men. And so like when he was 60 years old, 10 years old, 15 years old, he was talking to people in their 80s, 90s, 70s who related the oral traditions to him, and he kept this tradition, and it is part of his family tradition to keep this alive.
What do you think the accuracy of that might have been, Stephen? I'll tell you why. I remember in college once we did a little experiment where we had to whisper the beginning of a story through the ears of like 20 people.
Right.
By the time it got to the last person, the whole story had changed.
The old telephone thing, right?
Yeah.
We all did that. No, this is a tradition where it's not just a matter of sitting around campfires and listening to tall tales. It's a matter of hearing these stories over and over again and then having to repeat them.
Consistent, them then. Consistent stories.
Yes. Okay. Initiation. It's strictly kept. And over again. But also, the way Hakim teaches is so unique because he teaches from both sides of the brain. He can give you the left brain. He'll tell you what the glyphs mean. He'll tell you what the temple was, the physical evidence. But then he puts you into an altered state, very similar to what was done to Carlos Castaneda by Don Juan, who I believe was a real person. A lot of people think Castaneda totally made him up.
He was
I don't
a myth.
Agree.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Hakim can put you in an altered state of consciousness where he opens up your senses, where you can own the knowledge and you know it. He teaches something very specifically that when you own the knowledge, meaning from not just the brain, but from the heart, from your soul, from your spirit, however you want to access it, it's there. You own the knowledge and you know. You don't believe. So this is sometimes, which is sometimes very difficult for me when I discuss these things, because it comes off sounding arrogant. It comes off sounding egotistical. But to Hakim, these are not theories. He doesn't debate these things. It's either you accept it or you don't. This is their knowledge.
Did he ever tell you how he, or the stories of the pyramids and their construction?
Yes. A major part of the indigenous tradition is that, again, we call the Great Pyramid a spiritual machine. So it was created by people in a very high state of consciousness, and they had a knowledge of the use of crystal, the use of running water, and the use of sound. Those three things in combination were how the stone was cut, shaped,
and moved,
and lifted. So we're talking about anti-gravitics.
Almost sounds like what Edward Leed Scanlon might have done.
You read my mind. We were going that way.
Yeah.
I mean, Edward Leed Scanlon, and there's a major chapter in Chris Dunn's book, The Giza Power Plant, about Edward Leed Scanlon. Chris Dunn has been to Coral Castle, has made some great observations there. Edward Leed Scanlon always said he knew how the Great Pyramid was built, and we believe he developed anti-gravity
fields
to do that.
Does Hakim have the formula for how this is done, or does he merely know how it is done?
Wow. You know, the formula... Again, we, Chris Dunn and I have discussed this many times. We don't think we're ever going to discover any blueprints. Certainly the pyramid was built before writing, so it's not going to be written about.
Yeah.
And one of the mysteries, which even the people who try to give it a dynastic date, there are so many people say they can prove the Great Pyramid was built 2700 BC, 2900 BC, but yet the dynastic Egyptians themselves left no written records how the pyramid was built, because they didn't know anymore.
There's got to be some kind of schematic somewhere.
No. This is the idea, George, and this is why it's hard for us to understand. We discuss this all the time when we're on tour in Egypt. The people had the consciousness where it just appeared in their mind. Now, I use, as an example, Nikola Tesla, who you've talked about many times on your show.
One of the best. One of the greatest brains I think this planet's ever had.
Absolutely. And when Chris Dunn and I discuss this, we always joke and say, we think the Great Pyramid was built by a bunch of Nikola Teslas. How? Nikola Tesla always used to say that when he came to a point where he needed to create a machine, and he was the greatest inventor that the world has ever known. He's applied for more than 600 patents in his name, more than anybody else combined. Nikola Tesla owns patents in the U.S. He would say when he needed a machine to be developed, he would just visualize. He would see a black box in his mind. he would see all the parts go into the box that he needed for this machine, and lo and behold, the blueprint would appear in his mind. So that's why we're not going to find blueprints. They didn't write them down.
Remarkable.
They just conceived it in their minds, went and constructed it without any mistakes and errors. And it's very hard for us to conceive of that today.
All right. Somewhere along the line, though, this high technology, be it consciousness, a higher plane of consciousness, or in terms of high technology, the way we know what technology is, somewhere along the line, it faded away.
Yes. We fell. That's the fall. We always talk about it, all mythology, and it's amazing.
You mean the biblical fall?
Huh?
The biblical fall or something
well,
else?
Well, it's the fall that the fall becomes into the Bible. I think the Bible is a compilation of mythologies from many different peoples, from many different paths. So every mythology and all people have this idea that there was a golden age and then a fall from that state. So we're talking about natural cycles. These are these two last cycles of what I really concentrate in my current book. We were in a cycle of high state of consciousness. Then this cataclysm happened. It was a jolt. It threw people out of that reverie of a golden age, and we have fallen in consciousness. So why I label my book From Light into Darkness, I just had a friend tell the other day, he said, wait a minute, don't you mean the book should be From Darkness into Light? Because everybody assumes we've just gone in a straight line, that primitive people were crude, underdeveloped, didn't have the abilities, and we're in the light today.
No. And Michael Cremo would agree with you.
Exactly. And Cremo and Thompson are one of my people I depend on a lot. We have devolved. The last 5,000 years,
sure,
we've been in a stage of darkness. So we actually fell from this high state of consciousness.
But you see this cycle turning back now the other way?
Yes. The first book, Land of Osiris, talks about it. I end the second book. We're now in a new dawn. This is Hakim's teaching. This is why we will end with a positive affirmation for our message tonight, that we're now coming back into the dawn. The light is coming. I believe, George, no matter what's going on in the world today, no matter how many people have said that things seem so bad, it seems no way out of it, and we can talk about the war on terrorism, the New World Order. We will get to that, I'm sure, next hour. I think that it's inevitable. There's nothing can change it, that we are coming to the light. Consciousness is going to come back. People are waking up all over the planet. Nothing can stop it.
When I was a kid, and I'm reading comic books,
yes,
I would see these little ads in there for sending away for information from the Rosicrucian Society.
Yes.
I mean, I would look at that, and I never knew what it was.
Neither did I.
And I was just puzzled and also very interested in what they did. The Ancient Mystical Order, right?
Right. Ancient Mystical Order, Rosicrucis, AMORC, A-M-O-R-C.
What did they do?
Well, we're coming to the top of the hour. This will be almost a great thing to jump into, because I saw those same magazines when I was a kid, and I always wondered, what is this group? But I saw Rosicrucian, Rosy Cross, and not being a Christian, I rejected it and said, well, it's not important. But what led me to the Rosicrucian Order was my study of Egyptology.
Interesting. I mean, I was fascinated by it because they were everywhere.
Yes.
They were in my Superman comics. They were, I mean, I couldn't go anyplace. Now, but why were they going after me as a kid? Why weren't they just trying to go after adults?
Well, you know, because it was a system that took many years to develop, and it actually, I mean, it's actually antiquated now, but the system evolved from a man named Harvey Spencer Lewis, who we'll talk about, who was a modern imperator of the Rosicrucian Order in America from 1909 to 1939. And when we get into our photographs, we'll actually be able to see him. We'll maybe do that next hour. But he developed this idea of monographs by mail. So there was a way that you could send away, and they wanted to attract young people, because it's a system that at that time took many years to go through all the teachings. So the idea was to try to recruit young people, to try to get them involved.
I almost rode away for it, because
wow,
I loved getting things in the mail when I was a kid.
Yes.
I mean, I would order my little rockets, and they'd come in the mail and things like that. I just loved it. And then, you know, when your mail would get there and your postman was there and he said, here's your little package, George.
Yeah.
I mean, so I almost rode away from it, but I just couldn't understand what it was. And I was afraid my mother would get mad at me.
Right, right, right. And it has to be like maybe someone in the family who was a push. Like if you'd had someone who was a Mason in your family or had been a Rosicrucian, you know, then it would have been something you could have identified with. It would have been easier.
Yeah, exactly.
For myself, I didn't have anyone in the family.
All right, stay with us. Lots more to talk about with you, Stephen. Stephen Mailer, our guest, right here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Norrie. Be right back. Stephen, one thing to consider when we come back from the break, I love your theory. It is fascinating about the different races on this planet coming from different regions of the universe. But what about, you know, dogs, for example, and birds and cats? They're all similar, but they're different. Does that mean they all came too? Think about that. Back with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, Stephen, the question, of course, is we have dogs and cats. They're all alike, like humans, but they're all different. Did they come from other planets, other systems? Hello, Stephen? Ooh, where is he? Well, Tommy, you'll have to get him back in, and we'll get you back up. You got that, Dan? Okay, Steve, are you there? Nope. He is not there. We will need to reconnect as soon as we can. And we'll call him right back and get you in the system. Well, we're talking to Steve Mailer, and this is where I do the best I can with no guest and no phones. So hear me out for a moment, because what we're talking about is his book, From Light into Darkness. It's called The Evolution of Religion into Ancient Egypt. Now, some of his theories are pretty fascinating indeed. When he talks about the Egyptians being at least 65,000 years old, that's a long, long time, quite frankly. And, you know, different people who have studied the subjects of Egyptology have come up with their own conclusions, their own theories, and in this particular case, this is one of the most unusual ones, yet it's the one that could explain, I think, a lot of reasons why this planet is the way it is. Something happened a long, long time ago, and quite frankly, the research into Egyptology, why the pyramids were built the way they were, using sound, using some kind of consciousness, is a theory that was used by Edward Leete Scullin, for example, when he developed the Coral Castle as well. And I got to tell you, if we don't for some reason get Stephen Mailer back on, we will have to go to open lines, because we'll keep the show going. No need to go to any tapes or any programs like that. But I have no idea where he's gone or what has happened to him, because he has just simply disappeared totally. So he is out in the system, and he is gone. So let me see if we can go to some other calls right now. And nope, nothing seems to be working right now, folks. So just bear with me for a little bit. Let me tell you about his website. I'll tell you about mine. It's GizaPyramid.com, GizaPyramid.com, and our email is george@coasttocoastam.com as well, and that is the way it is for now. So we'll try to get one more connection with Stephen Mailer. If we do not get it, we'll go into open lines, and we'll do the rest of the show, just you and me, quite frankly. Other than that, first hour, talked about that very unusual plane crash near Greece, and we'll do some follow-ups to that as well, too. Stephen, are you there?
Yes, George, I'm back.
What happened to you?
Well, I hate to say that we're having another Jordan Maxwell experience, but that's what it seems like.
Your phone just went?
Yeah, you just clicked out. You went dead, yep.
Well,
you know, and I'm a very good friend of Jordan Maxwell, and I talked to him about that incident, so I hope nobody's playing with us.
That was very strange indeed.
Yes. Anyways, and we haven't even gotten into secret societies yet.
I danced and bumbled my way through 6 minutes
you
without
you. You did
great.
You did great. Thank you.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm not an expert in Egyptology like you are.
well, let's get – I did hear your question, so immediately when the phone went dead, I turned on the radio.
Okay.
You make a good point. Where do dogs, where do cats, where do birds? I believe – that everything is an essence, and that all the essences may have come. I mean, again, I think this planet is a great playground. It's a great experiment for who and for whom, the gods, God, whatever people want to say. And so, yes, dogs may have come from another star system, cats. You know, it's very interesting. I once remember reading an entomologist saying that biologists can't explain bees. Now, bees seem to be similar to other insects in this planet, but he was this person was making a viable theory that there's no way to explain that bees have evolved in this planet, that they may have come from somewhere else. So that is my answer to that. I think all the essences which we call species today may have come from all different places and have come to this planet for this great experiment.
Well, you know, I like your theory. I mean, because it's one of the few that makes some sense into why everybody is similar but different.
Yes. Yes. And again, this whole idea that one species has evolved into another. Well, yes. I mean, biology says our DNA is similar to chimpanzees, only different by a little bit. Our body structure, skeletal structure is the same. But I don't believe any species has ever evolved into another. I think we are all different essences.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit, if we can, about the Rosicrucian Society first and foremost, because that is an evolution into what we've been talking about right now.
Yes, and there was a specific reason why I had to go into detail in this current book about them. And again, we say Rosicrucian Order. Now, not to, you know, to be pedantic about it, but there are many different groups who've called themselves Rosicrucian. There has been a Rosicrucian Society, Rosicrucian Fellowship. The organization that I connected with in San Jose, California, is known as the Rosicrucian Order AMARC, and they're the only organization in the world that can call itself the Rosicrucian Order. Now, what led me to them was my interest in Egyptology, because 1972, I got out of the Air Force after 4 years during the Vietnam conflict. I am a Vietnam veteran. And came to San Jose, California to do graduate work at San Jose State University. Now, living in San Jose, I discovered that there are two major tourist attractions in that town. One is known as the Winchester Mystery House, which was created by the widow of the man who developed the Winchester rifle.
Okay.
A strange place. But in the 16 years of living in San Jose, I never went there. The other was known as Rosicrucian Park. It was this complex of four square blocks that had a planetarium, a museum, offices, and a theater. And I found, going around there, that there was all Egyptian architecture in this place. Now, I said, now, wait a minute. Anything I had ever read or learned about the Rosicrucians, and it was very little at that time, this is the 70s, was that it was an organization that began in the 17th century in Europe. There was never any mention of Egypt being involved. So I said, now, wait a minute, what's going on? Well, the one thing led to another. A friend of mine got employed at Rosicrucian Park. We were involved in doing professional theater together. And we convinced the officers of the Rosicrucian Order to allow us to put on a play at Rosicrucian Park in 1977. It was Arthur Miller's The Crucible. In the course of that, I got to meet many people who came out to try out for our play who were Rosicrucians. And I was fascinated with these people coming from all different races, all different religions, all different socioeconomic, ethnic backgrounds, all for this common ideal of studying mysticism and metaphysics. So I began to investigate and get seriously interested in the Rosicrucian Order, went to work there, joined the order. Now, in the course of that, I became a staff research scientist, which enabled me to have access to the archives and the library. And that's how I was able to write this chapter
in
my book.
And does it go way, way back, those archives?
Yes. I saw documents that go back to Middle Ages and before, but I saw artifacts that go back to ancient Egypt. And there was the connection. So I found out that this Rosicrucian Order began, as I said, in 1909 by naming Harvey Spencer Lewis. And if people go to the photographs that Lex has kindly put up, and they just skip to the last one, the fifth one, there is a beautiful painting that is, I took a photograph, it's in my book, of Harvey Spencer Lewis, so they can see what he looked like.
Did they not go, the Rosicrucians, did they not go to Egypt in the 1920s as well?
Yes, thank you, George. Yeah. There's a photograph in my book. Harvey Spencer Lewis led the first modern expedition of Rosicrucians to Egypt in 1929, and I have a photograph in my current book that documents that. But Harvey Spencer Lewis himself, born to a Protestant family, became very interested, had natural psychic gifts. And, you know, to make a long story short, I get his history in my book. He had a psychic reading around the turn of the 20th century where a woman told him he was connected to the Rosicrucians in Egypt. Now, he'd never heard that either. And all in his investigations, he'd never heard of any Rosicrucian order in Egypt. Well, to make a long story short, he began to investigate, contacted some Masons in France. They told him to come to France. They investigated him. They quizzed him, and they decided that he was legitimate. He was seriously a serious seeker. He was sent to the south of France, where he was initiated into the Rosicrucian order, and he was given the jurisdiction to begin the order again in North and South America, which he did in 1914. And his investigations said that the Rosicrucian order went back to ancient Egypt, specifically to the 18th dynasty of the New Kingdom, which is about 1400 BC, 3,400 years ago. And that's the history that I document in my book.
Let's spend some time here, Stephen, talking about the great cataclysm of 9500 BC that you mentioned and its implications. And does that have anything to do with the flood, the Noah flood?
Yes, I believe that's where it came from. I believe, again, I'm talking about a worldwide deluge, talking about tsunamis 1,000 feet high. The flood, and again, I would refer people, if they want more documentation, to the book Cataclysm 9500 BC, because they meticulously document that at least 250 different myths from people around the world all talk about a flood. It's something that, you know, there are many scientists, archaeologists, geologists who are trying to say that it was a local event in the Middle East, and that's the source of the Bible story. I think it was a myth that occurred over and over from people all around the world because it was cataclysmic, it was worldwide.
Well, was someone like a Noah tipped off that something was going to happen?
Possibly so. I mean, people definitely survived. We're still here today.
All right, so let's assume this for a moment. Let's assume that there was an asteroid coming our way. They knew it. I mean, we're predicting one out there around 2036, for example.
Right.
Okay? So let's assume that extraterrestrials might have been on the planet, may have been doing some genetic altering, who knows what.
Right.
But they knew that an asteroid was coming this way. They probably couldn't stop it, but at least they knew it was going to hit. And they gave a few people, like a Noah, warning that you've got a couple of years to prepare for this. Is that possible? Some
yes,
kind of scenario like that?
Zachariah Sitchin also records that as far as Sumerian myths go. I think that is what happened. I think, again, whether they were warned by the gods, if you will, or by their own wisdom, they did know it was going to happen. Preparations were made. Ships were sent out. People migrated, escaped. But the mere fact of the matter is probably better than 99% of all civilizations were on the planet at that time were wiped out, and maybe a great percentage of humanity went down in the deluge. And those that survived, Barbara Hand Clow talks about it in her book, Catastrophobia, they kept this scar with them of this great cataclysm that became the source of all the great creation mythologies of all the people that survived, passed the stories on. That became the beginning of the oral tradition. And humanity changed after that.
How would we record a disaster like that today?
It's in the creation myth.
And then 10,000 years from now, I wonder what people would be saying.
Right.
You know, we would say our cities are all wiped out from this huge whatever it might have been.
Exactly. And that would be passed down in the stories to the people who survived. And they would turn it into a great mythology. Like, again, it becomes the wrath of the gods.
Is that the reason why the technology was lost?
Yes.
Because so many people were gone with it?
Yes. But again, not completely lost, because I believe there's evidence that there were continued development, the continued building of temples in Egypt, stone temples, but it began as, again, the cycle shifted and consciousness began to wane after the cataclysm. So, I mean, one of the great mysteries that Egyptologists can never explain is this de-evolution, this retrograde. You look, even in so-called dynastic time periods, you look at the Old Kingdom, which is when they think the Great Pyramid was built. But we know structures built in the Old Kingdom. Then we see, and the type of hieroglyphs, the type of jewelry, the type of art that's produced. And then as it goes forward to what's called the Middle Kingdom, it devolves. It's less advanced. To the New Kingdom, where they're not, we know for a fact in the New Kingdom, they didn't build in granite or limestone anymore, but in sandstone, a much softer stone, easy to work with. So one of the mysteries in the Egyptology is, as you look at the so-called dynastic history, it degenerates as we go forward against this idea of linear evolution. And that's because the technology was lost. And we've just rediscovered things. It's amazing. One of the things in the 1880s, we discovered Portland cement. And then we have the cement that we use today. And it's known that the Romans had inherited the great idea of building and technology, and they had cement. So we, from you're talking about from the time of Rome to the 1880s, we didn't have this ability to use cement. So we were just rediscovering today what we already knew. But yes, to answer your question, the technology definitely decreased, and we almost go what we talk about the Neolithic period around 8,000 BC, where we just went back to a Stone Age.
Now,
we were very crude in our development.
Now, that the offshoots then of this faith-based belief that they that started in Egypt, how did that then begin to trickle out and go all around the planet?
Well, I believe the first great modern religion began in dynastic Egypt 5,000 years ago. So now you have these myths, these stories, and you have then a group of people who used certain techniques to keep their consciousness high. These are what we call the early shamans. These are the people who discovered psychoactive plants and used drugs not just to get high as people do today, but to keep themselves in a high state of awareness, to be aware of things with people who didn't were suddenly starting to lose that consciousness. So they developed techniques, they developed rituals, they developed mythologies, they created religion.
The incredible technologies that they had, how do you think they got it?
I think it was just a matter of consciousness. A matter, again, this is why we're not going to find the blueprints. It's just a matter of being in this high state of consciousness.
You don't think it was handed down to them by some other...
Yes. Again, the stories, a lot of the techniques were still handed down, as you mentioned before, from master to disciple. But they were kept in small groups where it wasn't then everybody. At one time, we believe all people had access to this degree of consciousness and could be aware of when they were building the Great Pyramid, everybody was in the consciousness understanding how it was being done, what was done. This devolved to only small groups of people. And again, George, to lead into I know where you want to go, this is how secret societies evolved.
Yeah, absolutely, because these societies, which we'll talk about when we come back from this break shortly, we have a few moments here, but these societies came from this, and then at what point did they decide they wanted to run the planet?
Oh, boy. Let's do that after break, because that's a good story. That's exactly why I wrote the chapter on the Rosicrucians that I did, why I want to talk to you tonight about the Illuminati, the One World Order, all of that.
Is it all connected?
Yes, all connected.
Well, that's what I thought. And what is Hakim doing these days?
Hakim is basically retired.
How old is he?
He's 75.
All right.
But, you know, I always use the quote of Indiana Jones, it's not the years, it's the mileage. The man has been for over 60 years going in, up and down tombs, climbing in and out of pyramids, so he needs a rest now.
I always use a quote from one of the Indiana Jones movies with my son, because whenever we email each other back and forth, he ends it by saying, "A penitent man shall pass."
Ah,
remember that part of the movie?
I love it. Yes, yep. I love that. I love it. A penitent man shall pass.
You had to kneel in order for that blade that came.
Yep. A penitent man is humble before God.
That's right. Absolutely. These theories that you subscribe to, you're beginning to get more and more support for.
Yes. That's what's great. It's just wonderful that you guys do what you do. If people go to the Great Pyramid of Giza website, they will see an international board of scientists who, including some of the most outstanding theoretical physicists in the world, and people like J.J. Hertek, like Joe Parr. I mean, many people I could name. We're getting more and more support all the time for these ideas.
Okay, will you stay with us, Stephen Mailer? Let's make sure you don't get attacked and clicked off again. We'll come back and talk about the Illuminati, the One World Order, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest, Stephen Mailer. Stephen, are you saying that the Illuminati, this push for a one-world order and government, all started during these days thousands and thousands of years ago? Whoop, he's not there. Now, this has got to be the most bizarre thing I've ever seen. So we'll do that again, and we'll get him right back on again, I hope. The gremlins are out today. They're out to get us. You know, some time ago when we had guest Jordan Maxwell on, expert Jordan Maxwell, not only did his phone go out toward the end of the interview, but he received all kinds of bizarre death threats and everything else. Now, Stephen, you're back?
Yes, we had it happened again, George. They don't want us to talk about
it. Now, let me ask you something. When you're on, do you hang up the phone?
No. No. What's happened is the radio gets really loud, and then the phone just cuts off. I am not hanging up.
Okay, so it just clicks.
Yes, and it just goes dead.
Do you hear me at all?
I hear, when we went into break, I heard the commercials, and it got loud and then ended, and then the phone was dead. But I have not hung up the phone.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah, well... we'll talk about it, though. They can't stop us. So
we'll get our engineering department on this ASAP to see if there's some kind of a glitch here. I mean, it's unusual for it to be two times in a row.
I know.
Okay, anyways, the question, of course, is the Illuminati, the One World Government, all that. Do you think this started thousands and thousands of years ago?
The trend towards. Now, what I want to make clear, and this is one of the things why I'm wondering... This never happens when Alex Jones is on, but he's one of my favorites when he comes on to talk to you. Now, and Jordan Maxwell. There are many people who talk about these things, and it always seems to come that the explanation is that this has always been this way, that these organizations have always been out to total control to keep us in darkness. And the key thing I try to bring out is it didn't begin that way. Now, even look at the word Illuminati. Illumin, it means light. So the idea is that in dynastic Egypt, when religion first evolved, then religion became a system to control and to keep people in a certain mindset. So certain groups formed part of the oral tradition to try to keep the ancient wisdom alive. It's the terms that come out in the metaphysical literature are like the Great White Brotherhood or the White Lodge. Now, those terms, particularly White Brotherhood, is not politically correct anymore because it sounds racist and sexist. But, you know, it wasn't. White didn't mean race. It meant light. Brotherhood meant men and women. But they began, the first secret societies were reactions against the excesses of religion that was trying to control people. And their idea was to try to keep ancient wisdom alive. So this is where the original word Illuminati comes from.
Then what happened to them? Why did they change?
Because we're in this cycle of darkness. So in this cycle, everything, every system, every belief system that has come about has become co-opted and corrupted. And again, I talk about religion in that respect in my book. But these secret societies, Illuminati, Rosicrucians, Masons, everybody tries to lump them together in the New World Order. What has happened, particularly in the last couple hundred years, is these societies have become infiltrated. Now, I don't know for sure. I mentioned in my book the modern term Illuminati began in 1775. A gentleman named Adam Weishaupt, who was a Jesuit, formed what's known as the Bavarian Illuminati. I've not done enough research myself to be able to say whether he began that organization to control people to start this new world order. But what has happened, definitely what has occurred, is the organizations have become infiltrated by groups that do want to keep people in darkness and want to control the world. There's a great example of that in the 1920s, in the Masons of Italy, what's known as the P2 Lodge, Propaganda Due in Italian, became infiltrated by the fascists of Mussolini and tried to control the Masons. I know for a fact, I don't go into this in my book, but it's something we can discuss, that the Rosicrucian Order that I was involved with in 1987, 1988 was attempted to be co-opted by the Moonies, which are connected to the CIA.
I'm beginning to think the Illuminati owns the phone company.
Well, they're trying to. So the point, George, today is that these organizations that are trying to control this new world order are definitely people who go back to this whole concept of the age we're in to try to keep us in darkness. But my point is the original intent of the so-called secret societies, particularly the Rosicrucians and the Masons and the Knights Templar, was to try to bring light, to try to keep people out of darkness, to try to keep the ancient wisdom alive. But a lot of these groups, and this is why I tell people they have to be discerning. There are many groups who call themselves the Knights Templar. There are many groups who call themselves Rosicrucian and Mason, and they're not the original intent to bring light, but to control and bring darkness. And so that's why we come up with the idea today of the New World Order, the Illuminati, that's out to control.
But they changed, and they've changed in a bad way, Stephen.
Well, that's the cycle, George, and this is the point where I said we were going to leave with a positive note. They're not going to win, because the light is coming, the dawn is coming, they can't stop it. It certainly looks bad, and that's why I say that the whole idea of terrorism, the war on terrorism, the whole wars around the world, the whole distrust, the whole idea of trying to keep people, you've got Christians distrusting Jews, Jews and Christians distrusting Muslims, Muslims hating Christians and Jews. This whole idea is to try to keep people separated and in darkness, but they will not win. No matter how many times they cut me off speaking tonight to you on the phone, they will not win. And how many of us that they've eliminated and moved out of the physical body, they still will not win.
Well, I've got to tell you, how bizarre is, I've had two guests where they've had severe phone problems.
Jordan Maxwell and
Jordan
me.
Was one, and you,
yes.
Both of you, talking about the same thing.
Interesting,
now,
isn't it?
I'm a guy who doesn't believe in coincidences, as you well know, Steve, in
absolutely,
listening to this
George.
Program.
So, I had long discussions with Jordan about that after your show, because I was listening that night. I'm a big Jordan Maxwell fan.
What can one deduce from this very strange irony?
They don't want us to know the truth about the fact that these things are not inevitable. In other words, that we don't have to stay separated, that we don't, how we're going to win the war on terrorism is stop believing these leaders.
But they have this kind of technological control where
they can
zap a button wipe you off?
Absolutely. They can make it appear that somebody died of a heart attack, that it wasn't a heart attack. There's a lot of people, you know, we're getting into conspiracy. A lot of people don't like to go that. But I know people who think that our great friend John Mack, who was supposedly hit by a car on a London street, was taken out. You've talked about all these microbiologists.
Yes.
Gene Maloff. You know, we've talked about these things. They try to take us out, but they can't win. I mean, they have all sorts of sophisticated. They're in control of the technology. They're in control of the media. They're in control of these things. But they're not in control of you, George, because you're here every night speaking for the light and speaking for the truth. They can't stop us.
You've got that right. Every night, indeed, and we'll continue to pound away at
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. If they take us out, there'll be somebody to take our place.
Of everything you've done, the research that you've done into this specific book then, From Light into Darkness, anything there bother you or scare you in the work you did?
No, because I've come to the point at the end of my book where I say there is nothing to fear. If there is no death, there is no physical death, how we've been controlled is by fear. That's how they control people, by keeping you afraid of death, afraid of someone invading your house, of somebody carrying a bomb into your bus, into your plane, into this, into that. It's fear. If we don't fear, then there's nothing that they can do to us. And I don't fear. I'm not afraid of anything.
Well, and if you don't fear, then you concentrate on more legitimate things.
Right, and I concentrate on the fact that this is just a cycle, and this cycle will end, and there's hope for humanity. Humanity will survive this.
Do you believe in life after death?
Yeah, in a way. You know, reincarnation is a difficult thing for me to discuss now because I don't believe in an individual soul. But yet I do believe we have access to the vibration of everyone who's ever lived before, and that the vibration, the basic essence that we go on, has never been created, never be destroyed. So, yes, it's a difficult, complicated answer to the question, but I believe that we do go on, our essence comes back, there's continual cycles.
But you do not believe in individual souls?
No.
Why not?
Well, that's part of Hakim's teachings that I leave at the end of my book, because we don't believe in separation. So to believe in an individual soul is actually to believe that we're separate beings. I think we are one soul. We're just reflections of the one soul. Now, people can call that one soul God. I call it spirit. But I believe we're all just reflections, so there is no separation, so we're not individuals. This is one of the great paradoxes of Buddhism, because Buddhism talks about reincarnation, yet they don't believe in an I. They don't believe in an ego, in an individual. So I prefer to use the word spirit. I believe in spirit. Spirit's never been created. It will never be destroyed. Spirit continues. And the essence that we are goes on. But I don't believe the ego, the personality, continues past the physical.
So if all this is true, then, then you don't believe in the angels or any of that.
Oh, yes, I do.
Oh,
see,
you
here's
do.
The paradox.
There is a paradox.
There's all these different essences. There's all these different vibrations. Some people call them angels. Some people call it, you know, whatever you want to call it, the past masters. I believe the essence of everyone who has ever lived is there that we can access. And that's what people do when they do readings. When they do past life readings, they call it, or psychic readings, they're connecting to the essence that's there. In India, it's called the Akashic Record. So it is a paradox, George. Again, it sounds like something is not true and true at the same time. I believe there is a continuum, and this continuum, I don't believe in a Big Bang. Hakim's teachings, the indigenous wisdom.
Well, I don't believe in a Big Bang either.
I don't think there ever was a beginning, and therefore there'll never be an end. So it's just continual cycles.
I find it difficult to believe that a little piece of matter, so minute, so small, one could not even see it with the naked eye or with any kind of a microscope, would explode and compress and then create all this energy and mass that we see out there right now.
Well, here's the great paradox of quantum physics right now. How does something, the created universe, which we call matter, come out of nothing?
I can't understand that. I went crazy trying to figure that out, Stephen, when I was a kid.
I know.
I was told, don't do it. It'll, you know, I really was. My my mother and my father, who were pretty spiritual, told me, don't try to answer that question, George. And I said, well, why not?
Right.
Mom, why not, Dad?
Right.
And their answer was, because you'll go crazy trying to figure it out.
Interesting. When I come from an Orthodox Jewish background. My father was once trained to be a rabbi. I once questioned him about the Kabbalah. He said that the Orthodox rabbis told him that anybody that studies the Kabbalah will either go crazy or commit suicide.
Well, I, and I'm not laughing to laugh. I mean, that's almost believable.
It is a paradox, George, and that's what, you know, you can't deal with this logically. You have to try to come from both sides of the brain, trust your experience as much as you can trust the intellect on this, because it cannot be understood. This is why people always say you can never explain God intellectually.
See, the way out is a lot of people who are true believers, and there's nothing wrong with that,
right,
but they will believe that it's faith, and that's the answer.
Right.
And for me, that's not good enough.
No.
I want to know how something came from nothing.
Exactly. I will give you the quote, a famous quote that I love to use, of Carl Jung. He was once interviewed by the BBC in 1965, and the gentleman asked him, well, did you believe in God when you were a boy? And he laughed and said, of course, everybody, you know, is taught to believe in God when you're a boy. And he says, well, do you believe in God now? And Jung paused, had the twinkle in his eye, and said, no, I don't believe, I know. And that's the mystic's answer. You have to trust your experience. So that sounds like faith, but it is not blind faith. It is something that you have personally experienced. The only way anybody can explain God, soul, is by having a personal experience that led you to that understanding. It can't come out of a book, and it can't be just blind faith.
I can't wait to hear you at the top of the hour when we take phone calls.
Boy, it's
because if you're not there again, then there's something going on here.
Well, if I'm not here again, you won't be able to take phone calls, because it's your system, that's not me.
And then we're going to call you back again. This is what I want you to do, though, this time. No matter what you hear,
right,
at least for a while, don't hang up.
Gotcha.
Don't hang up. And then if, obviously, you hear me in distress going, Stephen, because do you have a way to hear the radio show
when you cut off, I turn on the radio, and there's no problem.
Okay.
But what happens, George, is usually what happens when a phone goes dead, you then have that ring, and an operator comes on and say, if you want to make a call, please hang up.
Right. Right. That is strange. There are some gremlins out there somewhere.
But, well, sure. They don't want us to talk about these things.
Okay. And then when you hear me trying to introduce you and you're not there,
yes,
then hang up so we can get you.
Gotcha.
Just in case.
Just in case.
This is as weird as it comes. I'm wondering what would happen if I'm going to be in the cave in St. Louis in a few weeks.
Well, that's why I made the joke. How come this never happens when Alex Jones is on? That's what it should happen.
Well, hey, don't remind them. They'll come after him next, too.
Oh, I love Alex Jones.
But they do. They own the phone company. They got to.
Of course.
And so there's somebody there monitoring this show right now.
Right.
He's got your line, already knows where it is.
Right.
And they just hits the button every time during the top of the hour or during the break.
Right.
Simple as that.
Simple as that.
And he can't control our ability to call you back, though.
It looks that way.
But
glad
that. They're working on that one. They may have that
Let's not give them any ideas.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, well, let's get back into the matters at hand. So they had this technology. They used it to build the pyramids. They right. used it to move the tonnage of brick right. and stone. And then it was gone. Gone because of the Great Flood? Is that what wiped out the knowledge?
This cataclysm.
Okay.
The cataclysm that caused, and we can return to that. You know, I know you want to go to phone calls. We never did get to the photographs, but the first photograph that Lex was kind enough to put up is what Chris and I call the smoking gun. It's the upper wall of the Grand Gallery in the Great Pyramid that shows, and Chris Dunn discovered in 1999 that the upper wall of the Grand Gallery is granite, not limestone as been previously believed, and it's greatly blackened. It shows charring. So this is the smoking gun to us. This is what we think is remnant of this cataclysm. Something happened in the Great Pyramid, a fire, conflagration, great heat. The whole pyramid shook violently, and the grid line stopped. It just ended.
Now, for something like that to happen, it had to have been huge.
Huge. That's what we think is either a meteorite strike, a comet, a planetary flyby, you know, something which really disturbed the Earth and shook the whole Earth.
Maybe an explosion in the atmosphere?
Could be.
What about something nuclear?
Well, that's possible. There are people who have that theory. Hakim doesn't support that. He's, again, according to the indigenous tradition, it was a natural event, but which could mean a cataclysm, but a natural celestial event, not something that was caused by a war or by a bomb.
Interesting. Website, GizaPyramid.com. What do they find when they go to that?
They will find the Great Pyramid of Giza Research Association. They can scroll down and see my name. They can even see my book there. I'm one of the research directors, and they can see an international advisory board of credible scientists.
This book here, From Light into Darkness, where do you get it?
You can get it from Adventures Unlimited Press, Amazon, anywhere, or they can order it directly from me if they want a personal signed copy.
This is hot off the presses now, isn't
hot
it?
Hot off the presses. This came out a week and a half ago.
Now, can they also email you through your website?
Yes.
All right. Simple enough. They can email me, too, at george@coasttocoastam.com. All right, Stephen, when we come back, let's see if they nip you again.
Okay.
And this is getting fascinating.
Quite frankly,
this is almost as interesting as you being on the show. I want to see what they're going to do to you.
I know.
But we will open up the phone lines, give everybody an opportunity to chat with you. We'll keep you around for another hour.
Great.
With our very special guest, Stephen Mailer. And again, like he mentioned, his website, Giza, G-I-Z-A, pyramid.com. Just rush that together as one word, GizaPyramid.com. And I shall be back in a moment. Hopefully, Stephen will be too. So stand by for this one. Anything will happen on this night. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, it's your turn. We're going to take phone calls with our guest, Stephen Mailer. So we shall be right back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. This is the portion where you call the show. And let's go to our guest, Stephen Mailer, from Light into Darkness. Hey, Stephen, how are you?
I'm here.
See?
It didn't happen, George. It's after midnight, and we're going to let it all hang out.
Perhaps my instructions to you paid off, Stephen.
Yes.
You never know.
Well, whatever.
I find it fascinating that there are some beliefs about old-time Egypt that then evolved into other different areas of religion. Let's talk for a moment about Christianity, if I can. And, you know, I'm not making this the religious hour.
Yes, I know.
But how did this evolution that stemmed from Egypt create these various facets of religion?
Well, that's a good point, George. And I really concentrate on Judaism mostly in my book, but of course Christianity evolved out of Judaism. What we're led to believe, again, without getting too deep into a religious discussion, I know you don't want to go there, that these religions just appeared out of nowhere, that God revealed himself to Abraham, to Moses, and then his own begotten son, Jesus, and Muhammad was the only true prophet. What I'm showing is that there is an evolution, that there did come out of practices in ancient Egypt. Christianity, actually, people don't realize that the first real Christianity was in Egypt. The Coptic Christianity was the first place that Christianity really took hold before it took hold in the Middle East. So I see the lineage. I see how Judaism, the practices of Judaism, came out of the religion of Egypt, a reaction against the religion of Egypt, and how Christianity evolved out of Judaism, and Islam just followed up on the first two. So I see that there is way to show that there was an evolution, a lineage of these religions that came from the practices of ancient Egypt.
All right, let's go to the phones as promised. First-time caller line, welcome to the show. Where might you be calling from?
I'm calling from Bethesda, Maryland.
Oh, great. Welcome to the program.
George, I must say thank you very much for letting me on the air, and God bless you for the show that you have.
Thank you for calling.
I also want to say that your guest is consistent with a lot of things of oral traditions being handed down from generation to generation. And I agree with him on conscious technology and over a period of time. But I'm Hindu. And when you look at the old ancient Hindu text, you find that there's a lot of stuff that is mentioned from cycle to cycle also. And we are in the age of Kali Yuga.
Yes.
And this is the age of Kali Yuga. That's where evil is manifesting itself to a higher level. But I want to ask your guest there, because you know, he's talking about old ancient texts, and mm-hmm. he never mentioned anything about the Vedas, which is the oldest written book in the history of mankind.
Well, we could have gone there. I mean, we don't have a 5 or 10 hour program. We could have actually gone there, because there is the oral tradition that led to the Vedas. The tradition exists all throughout India, of the tradition that existed before the Vedas. And I want to bring out something to you, because you mentioned that. I don't know if you're aware of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi, the founder of Transcendental Meditation.
Yeah, Iowa.
Yes, he has just announced to the world that the Kali Yuga is over, that we have entered into Sat Yuga. So here we're talking about, and I could go on with you for a long time to show the parallels between the indigenous teachings I'm bringing out of Egypt and the traditions of India. The fact that you talked about the Kali Yuga being the cycle of darkness. Well, we're talking about this cycle of 5,000 years, which we call the Age of Amun, which is a cycle of darkness. So they correspond tremendously. But I'm also very aware of the tradition that the Vedas go back very, very ancient. And there also is in the south of India the Tamil tradition, the tradition that comes out of Sri Lanka that goes back long before the written Vedas, an oral tradition that led to the Vedas. So there is parallels there.
One other thing I want to add, George.
Sure,
you mentioned also about Christianity being coming out of Egyptian religion. There are a lot of parallels there, as your guest has said. But when you look at the Christian Trinity, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost, it came out of the Hindu Trinity of Brahma, Vishnu, Mahesh. And, you know, that's where the parallels goes through with all the religions on coming back to one source also at the same time. But anyway, thank you for getting me on air, George. And it's a pleasure talking to you. And keep up the good work. And I like you when you have more of Alex Jones online.
Okay.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being on the program.
Well, George, I'd like to interject there. I mean, there again shows the biases that I talk about. Now, not to put down the caller, not at all. But, see, people who grew up in Asia will come and say to you, well, religion began in Asia, civilization began in Asia, and that's where it began. People who come from the African tradition say, no, it came from Africa. The Polynesians say, no, it began in Polynesia. The Hopi say they were the original people. So, see, to me, it doesn't really matter where it all came from, that all these cultures fed each other, all these traditions fed into each other, and it did come from one source originally. It was all around the world.
You know, the Vedas talked about flying machines.
Absolutely,
did they not?
The Vimana.
Yep. Something was going on then.
They also talk about possible nuclear conflagrations.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. Hey, yes, Stephen. Good morning.
Yeah. Good morning.
Hey. Good show tonight. Question about Illuminati. You talked about the fact that they've been around for many, many thousands of years. In this age, in this day, are there still Illuminati, and how does one become one? And are they more powerful than G8, or could they be in G8? I'll hang up and listen, and I appreciate the show.
Okay, thanks.
Wow. Well, that's a long, involved answer. How one becomes an Illuminati, I don't know. I know that one can join the organizations, like one can join the Rosicrucian Order, one can join the International Order of Gnostic Templars through Mark Amaro Pinkham that I'm a member of.
I think it's family.
Excuse me?
I think it's all family-related, don't
yes.
you, Stephen?
Well,
I mean, you got to be in that club.
Yes.
I don't
when
think...
you're talking about the modern Illuminati, I agree. It comes down through certain family lines, absolutely. And I don't think what we call the modern Illuminati is a true mystical spiritual order that perhaps the gentleman was talking
in
about.
In terms of power, I think they're immensely powerful.
Absolutely. They are G8. They are Bilderbergers. They are the Trilateral Commission. There are all of these things, Skull and Bones. I mean, all of these things add into what the modern...
All they're going to do is watch what's going on with the price of oil. It doesn't make any sense at all for oil to be reaching these prices.
No.
It's all
contrived. There is not a shortage.
It's a design. If it's a shortage, it's created on purpose.
Absolutely.
And,
I just had a discussion with somebody today. We're just watching the gas prices in Colorado. That 1 week it goes up 10 cents, then it goes down 2 cents, then it goes up another 10 cents. I mean, it's obviously a controlled situation.
Of course. I'm telling you what will happen is this $3 a barrel mentality that we all see. I mean, a gallon.
Right.
They drop it to $2.50.
Right.
We're going to be saying Hosea's thinking, hey, this is great.
Right. Well, I just came back from Europe, where in England, gas is 90 pence per liter. There's 4.5 liters to the gallon, so they're paying $6 to $7 a gallon.
It doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't.
Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies line. Where are you calling from? Hi there.
Hi there, George and Stephen. This is Charlotte from Knoxville, Tennessee.
Hi, Charlotte. Go ahead.
Now, I wanted to ask a question. It was something Stephen was saying earlier when he was talking about his theory about the ego not surviving mm-hmm. after our death. And that made me think about what I went through as I began approaching, going to be approaching the age of 33 many years ago. I began going through a death process, which later I figured out way in the aftermath that it was basically an ego death because it took a 7-year cycle to completely go through it. And it was also an awakening process in the meantime. But one of the things in trying to understand what that was all about, I began studying astrology as well as other metaphysical things and finding out that I had a 12th house Pluto placement, which, George, by the way, you do too. I'm one of the ones working on your birth chart. But people with a 12th house Pluto go through some really strange and odd things through their life, just cycles of utter meaninglessness and maybe feeling kind of like a death process is setting in and things like that.
Sure.
And I was wondering, Stephen, have you gotten into any of this in your studies?
Yes, ma'am. Well, Pluto, of course, represents evolutionary change, and so it does represent that. But you're absolutely right, and I can give you an example. We say the Great Pyramid was a machine, but when it ended the machine, as I was talking about, it has been used in the last 5,000 years as a temple of initiation. One of the initiations that was done in the Great Pyramid is that an initiate would be left in the king's chamber, in the coffer, which is erroneously called a sarcophagus, 3 days without food and water. And what if a person didn't commit suicide or go absolutely insane? They would experience dying without actually having to die. And that's a very famous initiation that's been done by many, many different groups. And it is to understand, to have the death of the ego, as you mentioned, which you went through, so that you can realize that we are more than the body. And then you go in, then a person then becomes interested in mysticism and metaphysics, just as you are, can go into astrology, tarot, all the different systems. So what you experienced is one of the great ancient initiations, and that is to go through death without having actually physically to die so that we realize that we are more than the body.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Appreciate your call.
Thank you for the call.
Stephen, where do you go next with this work? What's next for you?
Well, it's again, we're trying to bring light. We're trying to help bring in the dawn. So I will continue to work with Hakim as long as he's in physical body. I continue to work with his family. We'll continue to bring people to Egypt to try to experience these things for themselves so that we can help raise consciousness all around the world and, bring in the dawn, what we call the awakening.
Nothing wrong with that.
Nope.
With that in mind, what are your comments about 2012, the Mayan calendar?
Well, again, it's just a date. We don't believe in dates. Actually, I think there's actually some people who believe the calendar's off, that it's actually we're in that stage now. It's interesting, again, this correspondence, this coinciding of different traditions. The Mayan calendar began some 5,000 years ago, this particular cycle. So does the Jewish calendar. So does the Aztec calendar. So did Hopi traditions. So what we're looking at in 2012, we will be coming, according to the Mayan system, to the end of this cycle. But it doesn't mean the end of the world. It doesn't mean total destruction. It means we're going into the next phase. That's what we're calling the awakening. And I think it's going to happen before. By 2012, it will be firmly in place. What Hakim has predicted for us, and he predicted this to me years ago, is that each year we go through, consciousness is going to be multiplying. So we're in it now. It's going each year, 2006, 2007, we'll all be going on this inevitable path to end this cycle of darkness and to bring in the awakening.
Let's go to our wild card line. It's your turn on Coast to Coast with us now. Hi.
Hi, Stephen. Thank you.
Sure thing.
You're
thank
welcome.
Your passion just, wow, it just comes right through the phone. It's incredible.
Thank you.
And I just really wanted to thank you. George, what a great show. I mean, you're just absolutely incredible what you do. And
well,
hat is off big time to you.
As long as the Illuminati doesn't get me.
Well, it's so great, Stephen. You know, there's so much fear-mongering. I mean, I love Alex Jones, but a lot of that stuff really gets you so whipped up. You
yes.
Know?
Yeah, that's the point. That's what the difference I try to bring into it. I mean, I respect people like that who are doing that work, but we have to try to bring the other side of it, that this is just a psycho. That we've gone through this before, we're going to come out the other side. So people will accuse me of reading this book of being an atheist. I am not an atheist.
Right.
I'm a highly spiritual person. If anything, I'm a pantheist.
Oh, totally and, tell that.
And so the message is one of hope and optimism, that once we can get people to rid themselves of their fears, then we'll all be the better for it as a total humanity.
Yeah, see, because all of this stuff, it just puts, I mean, George has like 10 million listeners, and it puts so much fear in. You rarely hear, it almost seemed like that would be the Illuminati's goal for
exactly.
Us, all of us listeners, because, I mean, obviously we listen to the show, we're all have somewhat higher consciousness, and we're all seeking to better ourselves.
I agree.
And to better the world, and for someone like yourself, as esteemed as you are, and especially with George, and to just give us this positive message, it's like so important, I think, right now to reaffirm the light. And
I totally agree, and that's why I try to get on as much as possible.
I can't thank you guys enough for that. And my quick question is, I was wondering what's your opinion on my buddy Hector and I have really gotten into Sir Lawrence Gardner and monatomic gold and how it's been used in different initiations in the pyramids and so forth. And what can you tell us about it if you're taking it, and is it okay? What do you think about it?
I have mixed opinions on it, but I actually have an appendix in my book where I discuss it. I don't think that Gardner is right about it being used in Egypt and about to the degree that he talks about it. They did do alchemical processes. They did develop certain techniques and elixirs probably to try to learn to believe life, but I don't think there's evidence that it was used in Egypt the way he said it was. So I think he's off on that one.
He does swear by that, though.
I know he does.
Okay, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Next up, let's go west of the Rockies. Your turn on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Oh, and eternally grateful for taking my call.
Sure, thanks, sir. No problem.
Gary, KSMA, 1240 AM, Santa Maria. I must respectfully disagree. There's one thing to have a positive attitude. There's another thing to be completely Pollyannish about the real world, and I believe that Stephen and the previous caller being very, very Pollyannish. We have about 30 to 40 million true enemies in the Muslim religion, but also in the past, Russia, KGB, China. We have a border that this president absolutely refuses to close. We will not be attacked by a nuclear missile. That's too easy to trace, and we would annihilate whatever country it came from. It's going to be a truck or a car bomb with a lead-lined trunk or bed driven right across the border into one of our cities, and it's going to go off, and life in America is going to be over as we know it. I don't care what people think about the illegal immigration issue, the taking of jobs, the health issues. The biggest issue is that anyone with enough motivation, with very little money, can just drive wherever they want to in this country, from the southern border especially, but also from Canada, and set off multiple nuclear warheads, unless they're already here, like your previous
true.
Guest, Paul Williams, said.
Yep, absolutely true.
That's the issue, people. No matter what you feel about illegal immigration, and even to the illegal aliens out there that are in this country, your gravy train will be over as soon as Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda could be set up as a straw man by either Russia or China that will nuke us. That's their only nobody is going to launch a nuclear strike by a missile. It'll be driven across our border. And all of you very well-off people, if you don't light up the phone lines and start really getting serious about closing this border and get a PIN code put on the driver's license and Social Security number after you verify you're an American, this country is going to be over. If you don't think it can happen, you haven't been listening to George's guests.
All right, thanks for your comments. Stephen, he's right about that.
Well, I agree. I mean, I'm not, you know, we can call me Pollyannish if he wants. I mean, I agree that that's going to happen, but I don't think closing the border is going to stop it either. If it's inevitable, if it's supposed to happen, if it's part of the cycle, it will happen. But my point is, it's not going to be the end of humanity. We've gone through this before. We'll go through it again. It's a matter of just... And to saying that it's Muslims that are the reason, that's the separatist thinking that's going to keep us in this age of darkness. If we realize that it is groups that are trying to perpetuate these things and they want to keep us in fear, and if we stay in fear, then we'll stay in the age of darkness. If we're not going to allow, I mean, these things could happen. I'm not saying not being alert. I'm not saying people not looking at strange people with rucksacks like we know what's going on in England right now. I mean, I'm not saying to be totally in, keep your head in the sand like an ostrich and ignore what's going on in the world. I listen to the news. I listen to Alex Jones. I'm aware of what's happening. But I'm saying that if we continue to remain in fear, it will never change.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, it's something that we continue to pound away at on this program because I want people to be aware of the dangers. When I was in school, I wrote a report that we had two choices in the future, and the future was 35 years ago when I was writing this thing, and that was either we would have to annihilate countries that would get sophisticated technology like they're getting now, or take a chance that everyone will have nuclear power and take a chance that somebody would try to take a bomb to us. There's only two scenarios there, and I'm not sure which one we've chosen yet. Stay with us. Stephen Mailer, our guest, the rest of your phone calls in this very fast night. I'm George Norrie. This is Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, first of all, first hour, well, it'll mark the 28th anniversary of the death of Elvis Presley, so we're going to have something on that. And then the main program will be Colin Bennett. He's called the bad man of ufology. Why? Well, you'll have to stick around and find out about that. On Wednesday, Scott Stevens, our guest, he is a television weather person, and he says that someone is manipulating the weather, and he can prove it. So we'll chat with Scott about that. On Thursday, we're going to talk about this situation in the Middle East with Israelis leaving the Gaza Strip and what just that means to all of us, because that is a major story. And then open lines right here on Friday, what I will call Full Moon Friday open lines. So get ready for that. Back in a moment with our guest, Stephen Mailer, and the rest of your phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Stephen, do you believe these mystery schools are still in existence today?
Absolutely. Like I said, I just joined one, the International Order of Gnostic Templars.
So why do they call them mystery schools?
Well, they were what were called the mysteries, the greater mysteries and the lesser mysteries. Now, the greater mysteries were things that we're talking about, the fact that everything is interconnected, that there is spirit, there has never been a beginning, there's only been cycles. But they were kept secret in this last 5,000 years, and this is why secret society has grown. The lesser mysteries was what became into the modern trappings of religion. So mysteries basically comes down to the fact that we cannot understand who we are, where we come from, where we're going by intellect alone. That's why it's a mystery.
All right, to the phones we go. Let's go to West of the Rockies. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, welcome. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Oregon, but I'm from Reno.
Okay.
Hey, first of all, I enjoy all your good discussions you have.
I spent a lot of time
driving, and I sure enjoy it. I hear you a couple of times referring to, you know, the Big Bang and how it doesn't seem to make much sense to you.
It's baffled both of us.
It tends to be baffling. I have a little insight into it, sort of, because I think about nothing a lot, I guess. But infinity, everybody always wonders how big is infinity, and you can't get a feeling of that. And the pre-Big Bang is just kind of like the opposite of that. It's almost there's nothing there. If you can almost imagine a void where there's nothing, then really at that point, as long as everything adds up to nothing, you can have infinity from that. It's kind of a it's a perspective kind of thing, and it's the hard thing is to imagine nothing.
Well, the key thing to understand is nothing doesn't mean no thing. It means everything. So that we're talking about vibrations. One of the basic teachings of the Rosicrucians that I have always loved, and it's a very scientific thing, is that all is vibration. That what quantum physics is telling us now is that we're just looking at vibrating particles, subatomic particles that keep being reduced, reduced, reduced. It just comes down to vibrations. But in essence, then, there is no vacuum of space, that there's energy waves, pulses going through space, going through everything continually. But most of it is invisible. So out of the invisible comes the visible.
Right, and I'm actually referring to before there was space. I mean, because before there was any particles, before there was any universe, there was nothing. There wasn't even space.
Yeah, but there that nothing was no thing. It becomes everything comes out of that nothing, so it's vibration.
That's right. And it is. It's truly the case. Yes, everything is. It all comes out of nothing, and then it is everything. It's infinite. It's infinite.
So and that's the mystery. There's where the mystery comes from.
Yeah, I guess it would have to be. I mean, this is kind of an unsolvable one, I think.
Well, I think it can only be experienced. It can't be understood intellectually.
That's
I think that's the problem.
Way to say it. Excellent. Yeah.
Yep.
Okay, I appreciate you being of the program, indeed. Stephen, you know Graham Hancock, don't you?
Yes, I do. I've met the man personally.
His theories are pretty astounding.
Yes, and I think, to me, the most important book he wrote was called Fingerprints of the Gods, where he's basically saying the same thing we are, that there's evidence of advanced civilization all around the planet over 10,000 years
ago. Let's talk a little bit about Christopher Dunn. Of course, he's been a guest on Coast to Coast, where
yes.
he believes that the Great Pyramid was indeed a power machine. What do you think they used the energy for?
Oh, boy, George, you always ask that question.
Yes.
Well, whatever they wanted. Again, everything that we know, at least in the material world, has to have energy. So they used the energy for whatever they needed, to run machines, to run their civilization, to light their houses. I believe, George, again, we come back to Nikola Tesla, that the Great Pyramid produced free energy. And so there weren't wires, there weren't connections, there weren't plugs, that people could just tap into the frequencies, and the Great Pyramid produced a myriad of energies. In fact, this is where we entertain different people's theories all the time. We don't even know all the levels of energy that the Great Pyramid produced, but it definitely produced hydrogen gas, produced microwaves, produced radio waves, produced all sorts of electromagnetic fields, and energies, again, that we don't even know. So they just tuned in to the energy, and energy ran their life, their civilization.
All right, next up, let's go to our first-time caller line. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello?
Yeah, hi.
Hi, my name's Jim. I'm calling from Santa Cruz.
Yeah, hello, Jim. Go ahead.
Oh, great.
I used to live in Santa Cruz. Great place.
Hello?
Yeah. I used to live in Santa Cruz.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah, wonderful place.
Yeah, it is. It's beautiful. Yeah, you guys got a great show tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
George and Jim, Stephen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I want to ask a question about the book, The Serious Mystery. There's in that book, there was a Dogon extraterrestrial who was from Sirius B, who was stranded in Africa, and he went from West Africa to Egypt, and he was trying to contact his own planet by constructing the pyramids. And as he transmitted a rescue beam, you know, supposedly he built the pyramids for that purpose. And this, you know, this Dogon extraterrestrial built some kind of a window, you know, through the pyramid that pointed to Sirius B. And I'm kind of wondering what, if you have any understanding about this Dogon extraterrestrial influence on the pyramids.
Yes. Again, we don't think the pyramids were built by extraterrestrials. However, I think the Dogon were one of the original Comitian tribes. And there's no doubt that the Comitian mythology was very concerned with Sirius, and they actually believed that the Sirius star system was one of the home planets. In fact, the Sphinx and all so-called lioness goddesses, they're called, represent beings that came. Now, I would recommend that you read a couple of books written by the woman I spoke about, Murray Hope. She wrote a book called The Peshats.
Okay.
And another book called The Lion People. She wrote a book called The Peshats and the Crystal People. The first book she wrote was called The Lion People. Now,
Sorry, what was the author?
Murray Hope, H-O-P-E, British authoress.
Okay.
Now, people, you know, this is channeled information. Now, I always tell people you take channeled information with large grains of salt.
Yeah, right.
But she claimed that she was communicating with beings who are now in the fifth dimension. They're not third dimensional anymore, called the Peshats. They're lion-headed beings. They came from the Sirius star system. They were part of that, which genetically engineered the ancient Egyptians, et cetera, et cetera. So, I don't believe that an extraterrestrial built the Great Pyramid, but I do believe that we are star seeds, and there's no doubt that the Dogon got those stories from ancient Kemet, because the Kemetians were very adamant that a lot of their lineage came from the Sirius star system.
You think the pyramids then were terrestrial? Or, I mean, what about like Zachariah Sitchin?
I mean, I don't support the idea that the Great Pyramid was built by extraterrestrials. Again, our oral tradition tells us that ancient African people were in a high level of consciousness. They built the pyramids. But as George has often said, the pyramids could have been used as a communication device to extraterrestrials, interdimensional.
Yeah, I mean, they say that, you know, possibly it was a means of a telescope, because the depth of the pyramid, you know, you could see out into space, you know, at a great distance.
Well, the pyramid had a multiplicity of functions, a myriad of functions. We don't even know all of them yet. But, I'm adamant in my belief, in the oral tradition I bring forward, that it was terrestrial people that built the Great Pyramid.
But they could have had instructions from the extraterrestrials.
Absolutely, George. Yeah. No problem there.
Okay. Hey, thanks for your call. Appreciate it. What do you think about parallel universes?
I think they exist. In fact, again, Barbara Hanclow, who I always seem to like to mention, talks about the fact that we could actually be living in other physical bodies and other star systems contiguous to this body we're in here. And that's what a lot of people get in dreams or in psychic experiences. I think that we are multidimensional beings, and we can be living in all levels of existence.
East of the Rockies, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Ryan in Orlando.
Hey, Ryan. Good to have you with us.
Thank you. Great show. Before I get to my question about the pyramids, I'd just like to point out my only personal experience with anything in regard to the Masons is a friend who was a good person and had a pretty rough life. And when he became a Mason, it just seems like since that point to this day, everything has gone his way in his personal work life, everything like that.
Is he still a good guy?
No, he's always been a good person, but it just seems like everything has definitely gone his way from that point on. My question about the pyramids is I've heard something in the past about their actual location, where they were built, and the preciseness of where they were built. Is there anything in regards to, like, if they're in the center of the continent that they're built on?
There is a belief that if you took all the continents, took a map of the world and put them together in one complete thing, that what the 30th parallel is, where the Great Pyramid is at Giza, is actually at the geodetic center of all land masses on the planet. So, yes. But what I talk about in my first book, The Land of Osiris, is that all the pyramids from Dashur in the south to Abu Wash in the north, which includes Giza and Saqqara, are all on a grid line, one of the major grid lines of our planet. And they were, Hakim has always said that the site dictates what's there. So when you have a sacred site anywhere in the world where you're going to have a temple, a church, a synagogue, they're usually on grid lines. So the Giza Plateau is one of the most powerful vortex grid lines on our planet. So it's not by accident that the Great Pyramid is there.
Well, again, great show. It's very interesting stuff. I appreciate it. Thank you.
All right. Good to have you with us indeed. Let's go now to our wild card line. Hi.
Hi, George.
Hello.
And good evening, Steve.
Good evening.
It was years ago, many years ago, back in San Jose, that you and I had a discussion, and you had mentioned something about redheads being sacrificed to Osiris.
Oh, no. I think what I mentioned is that there's evidence that there were red-headed people, a red-headed race of people in the early dynasties of Egypt. But other people have mentioned about sacrifices. I don't really, I've gotten into anything like that, but there's clear evidence that there were red. In fact, the mother of the people, the person that Egyptologists believe who built the Great Pyramid, Khufu was his title. Her title was Hetepheres, and she's clearly a redhead, shown in her tomb paintings.
Yes,
so there was a red-headed race.
All right, what's the significance of that, Stephen?
I don't know. Did they come from Scandinavia? Did they come from another star system? I don't know.
Would that in any way be connected with the Hyksos?
Well, no, I don't think so. I talk about, you want to read about the Hyksos. My current book, we talk about who the Hyksos really were, and they were not Israelites. They were not connected to the Exodus like a lot of authors believe.
Stephen, I've left my number with the producer.
Okay.
This is Marguerite from San Jose. Remember the play?
Yes.
Camino Real?
Yes. Yes, I do. How are you?
I'm fine.
Great.
Okay. I'll be up late if you care to call this evening or after the show.
Well, you can contact me by connecting to my email address through the web links that Lex has kindly put up on George's website.
Okay, and we'll pass the phone number on to you as well, Stephen.
Thank you.
You can keep that if you want.
There's an old Rosicrucian friend right there, George.
How many are there, by the way?
Wow. You know, one of the great things is that Harvey Spencer Lewis was very successful with Amarc. So at one time there were maybe as many as 300,000 Rosicrucians belonging to Amarc around the world. I don't believe it's that high now, but there certainly are many. And what amazed me was at least 65 different countries. So the Rosicrucian order spread all around the world.
Do you believe in a higher power?
Oh, yes.
You do?
I call it spirit, yes.
First-time caller line, welcome to the show. Hi there.
Hi, my name is Allie.
Hello, Allie.
It's a great show. Hi.
Thanks.
Hi.
I have a quick question, and then I'll hang up, and I can't wait for the answer. But I wonder what you can tell me about Coral Castle. I heard about a man that moved.
You'll love this answer.
Yeah, I definitely do. So I'll hang up and so I can run into the other room and listen.
Okay, we'll give you a few seconds to run into the other room so you can listen. Let's pick up by talking a little bit about Ed Leeds Skull.
Amazing man, George. He was all of 4'11", weighed about 98 pounds, and supposedly lifted hundreds of tons of coral by himself. So there's no doubt we spoke about it earlier. She may not have heard it. Chris Dunn has an excellent chapter about Coral Castle in his book, The Giza Power Plant. We believed he knew he used electromagnetic fields and radio waves to create anti-gravitic fields. And actually, it's an amazing story, and I'd like to pass this on. I don't know the woman's name, and I think she's passed away, but there was a person who said years ago that when she was a young girl, she and some friends had happened upon Edward Leeds Scanlon when he was moving the coral, and she went to her mother. She was maybe all of 5, 6
years
old. Yeah,
she was a kid.
She saw flying stones.
Yes, yes.
And nobody believed her because it's just a little girl.
And then he went and hid after that or something like that.
But we believe she actually witnessed him working with these energy lines and actually floating the beams into position. And so the answer is Edward Leeds Scanlon always said he knew how the pyramids were built. I believe he's right. He created anti-gravitic fields, and that's how he did thousands of tons of coral.
Do you think he built Coral Castle on certain ley lines and areas like that?
Good point. You know, Chris Dunn doesn't believe that. I think I agree. I think there were, because why we don't believe it is he actually moved it from its original position. And so either he was on the same grid line or he just, you know, it was the technique that he used. I believe in the grid lines, and I believe the grid lines are important to use anti-gravity, so I would say he did do that. But Chris Dunn denies that because at the original site he moved from, I think it was Florida. He moved to Homestead. I know that.
Yes, he moved. That's right.
And he moved 35 miles.
Right. He got beaten up or something, so he decided to move.
Exactly. Yeah. There were a lot of people trying to steal his secrets, you know, I think.
Well, we only got about a minute left, so let's just chit-chat. I won't have enough time to take any more calls here, Stephen.
Okay.
But please mention the book again, From Light into Darkness.
From Light into Darkness, The Evolution of Religion in Ancient Egypt. It's available from Adventures Unlimited Press, from Amazon, or from me personally for a signed copy. And I also, again, would like to mention that we have room available on our tour to Egypt, October 25th to November 6th. Please, anybody who's skeptical and wants to come, and Egypt is safe. I want to bring that out again clearly. A lot of people are worried right now, thinking I would say anywhere in Egypt is safer than anywhere in the United States, that we are protected, that we have very high security where we go, and that people are safe to travel with us. And we do have room available on our tour. People can see these things for themselves. That's all I ever ask. Come, look for yourself, judge for yourself, and then decide what people want to believe is the truth.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're very, I think, bullish on the future of society.
I am.
And that's a good thing.
And I am not Pollyannish like a person. I do believe that we have to listen to you, listen to Alex Jones, listen to the news, be alert, be aware. We don't want to let, you know, these things happen if we can avoid them. But I believe in the end it all will come out right.
Well, the bottom line is not to be foolish, just to be, you know.
And not to live in fear.
That's right. You can't live in fear.
No.
If you live in fear, they've won.
That's right.
And that's what they want. You got to be diligent.
The powers of darkness want.
And you got to do it. Very good. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you, George.
Appreciate you.
I have great respect for you and what you do.
All right, you take care.
Okay.
For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie. somewhere today, way out there. On Coast to Coast AM, I'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.